everyone. Welcome to another episode of Turning Pages, the podcast that celebrates African literature. My name is Vuvu Vena. Today we are visiting Ghana / South Africa in an interview with author Ikau Duka about his fourth novel, Yellowbone. We are of a folklore heritage. We were conceived in the womb of beautiful words, birthed into a captivating world that we've spent eternity trying to name, tell, retell, and paint. Wrapped and cradled in stories, intsomi namabali. Our words create worlds. They transport, they mirror, they convict, they give lashings and hugs. They create and can never be undone. To hide between the pages of a book is to find pieces of yourself before you even were. Welcome to Turning Pages, the podcast that celebrates African literature from the continent and the diaspora. I'm your host, Vuvu Vena. This episode was first featured on my YouTube channel as a live discussion with the author around his fourth novel, Yellowbone, which follows Karabo, a light-skinned girl living in Mthatha, who grew up with the hurtful cry of Yellowbone ringing in her ears. She hears her parents argue, not realizing that the question of her paternity is the cause. On a scholarship in London, Karabo attends a private recital where an antique violin binds her fate to that of virtuoso André Potgieter. He hides an inconceivable secret, though no saint himself. He is visited by angels, and he'd do anything to keep seeing them. Spanning South Africa, Britain, and Ghana, Yellowbone is an enthralling novel exploring identity, justice, deceit, and truth. This novel is published by Quella Books, an imprint of NB Publishers, and it was sent to me for review purposes. It also happened to be the first novel that we chose for my online book club, the Vuvu Vena Reads Book Club, which exists over on Facebook as a private group. The link to the book club will be shared on the show notes. If you are interested in joining, you can do so. There is no pressure up on there. You can join any book that you feel like you are interested in that we'll be reading. This year, we are only reading 6 books, which means that each book gets to run over a 2-month course. A little bit about Ikau Duka himself. Ikau Duka is an oil field engineer turned investment banker turned wannabe data scientist and part-time author. He was educated in Ghana, the United Kingdom, the United States, and France, and he currently lives in Johannesburg with his wife and kids. Among the things that we would like to find out about you, obviously the book does give us a little bit of your bio, where you were educated, that you've lived in a lot of other countries as well for short periods of time. We wanted to find out how you discovered that you wanted to be a writer.
Thank you very much for having me this morning. So how I discovered I wanted to be a writer, I think that comes from my mother. She was a teacher, and she always encouraged us to read a lot. And I always say that from reading a lot, it's not a big jump to wanting one day to write your own. So the origin of my urge to want to write certainly goes back to my mother.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what kind of books would you say that you grew up reading, or what kind of books would you pinpoint to having had a great impact on your life?
Well, I grew up, I grew up in Ghana, and I grew up reading a lot of English books. So a lot of your English authors, and also some South African authors as well. It was only in my teens and early 20s that I really started reading more and more African books. So of course I read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart. More recently, I have been reading the works by Chimamanda. So I would say that my reading journey has been quite varied. But then it started off when I was very small, like 5 or 6, by reading a lot of the classical English books.
Okay. And then with such a, you chose quite analytical careers, right? I understand you worked as an oil field engineer, that you are in data science, etc. How would you, or how have you married your analytical side with your creative side in how you write?
Well, I actually started writing when I was in Libya. So working as an oil field engineer. So the company sent me to the middle of the Sahara, and there's not a lot to do. There's not a lot to see. So when you're not working, you have a lot of spare time. So I started writing for the company magazine, who at the time would encourage the engineers to send in a little snippet on what it's like to work in Libya, for example. So that's when I started to write. And I kind of realized or got an inkling that people might like what I write when I went to the headquarters of the company for a training course. And the company was headquartered in Paris. And the lady who managed or run the company magazine heard I would be coming. And she came looking for me because she wanted to see who it was who had been sending her those articles. So that's really where it started for me. So I suppose if I'd been doing something else that had not as many gaps in the working day, then I may not have thought to write at all. You know, but I think that there was something about the solitude of the desert and being so far away from anybody and anything that led me to want to write. And that has sort of stayed with me ever since.
That's very interesting. So in your latest book, you tackle a lot of different themes, but it looks like one of the main themes on there is the issue of colorism, right? And colorism has come about in different generations with different names over the years. And it's something that remains topical and very important in conversation and in society. You do mention in your later part of the book, when you talk about your acknowledgements, that this came about when you had heard Figile Mbalula, when he was still a minister of police, commenting on a femicide victim's skin tone, that was Karabo Mokoena in 2017, after she was allegedly murdered by her boyfriend at the time. Can you tell us what it is about that comment and what the comment was that actually sparked Yellow Bone into being, as in Yellow Bone being your latest book?
Right, so I remember that that morning, my wife showed me the video. And it was a video on YouTube where the minister was speaking to police. And I believe it was in the week where her body had been found. And one of the first things he said was words to the effect, how could they kill such a beautiful woman? How could they kill a yellow bone? And it just struck me that why would that be the thing about her that's the most important thing to say? And I never had the opportunity of meeting Karabo, but she's actually my wife's cousin. The added confluence of the absurdity of what he said and her death sort of being so close to home led me to want to write something about that. Though I must say that the book itself, so regardless of the title, it's not really, I like to think that the colorism theme is not the most prominent thing. I feel that there are other nuances and arcs within the book that I wanted to explore, but certainly you're right that the spark or the impetus or the reason or wanting to write came from watching that Fikile Mbalula video that day. I think it was back in 2017, yes.
Okay. So as I had mentioned to you ahead of this live, the point of the lives is to get as many people who want to engage with you, especially about Yellowbone, to ask any questions that they want. We have a few people online right now. So guys, it's up to you. You guys can ask questions, but in the meantime, I will continue having a conversation with Ekow. So as and when the questions come in, I will break for you to be able to answer those, if that's okay. So talking about the various themes, can we talk about, okay, the themes that are associated with one of the other main characters being Andre, right? So he sees angels. I've never come across the terminology of seeing shapes while you hear music. So he sees angels when he hears music, right? And he talks about it a little bit more as the book progresses. And when we meet him again in Ghana, we see that other people also have the same inclination. What drove you to bring that kind of theme into this story?
I think where that comes from is, and I think it's two things. One is, I've always been attracted to awkward characters, to people who don't necessarily fit in. And I thought that Andre was like that. He's not very comfortable in his own skin. He's not very comfortable in his environment. He's a bit of a misfit. And I tend to be drawn to characters and people like that. And I also stumbled upon the notion of synesthesia, which is a real thing, where there are people who seem to have their nerves jumbled up or miswired. So when they see something, it may trigger a sound, or when they smell something, they may see shapes and colors. And I thought to take it to the extreme and have him, when he hears or plays a piece of very beautiful music, he literally sees angels. So that's where that came from. I thought it was an interesting medical condition that might add some flavor to the story.
Snovuya says she doesn't have a question, but she'd like to thank you for taking us on a trip around the world from Mthatha to London to Ghana. Why those specific areas? Is it because you have lived in those areas, or is it because they had another significance to your life or to the story?
Right. I've obviously lived in Ghana. I'm from Ghana. I have also spent some time in London. Strangely enough, I've never been to Mthatha.
Well, I'm from Mthatha.
Oh, right. Okay, great. There was another lady from Mthatha who called me out on some of the settings in the city. She said it didn't quite ring true. And I hold my hand up there. I haven't been to Mthatha before. But the reason I chose to situate the first part of the story there was because I remember growing up, lots of professionals, and specifically teachers and medical doctors, who left Ghana to move to the Eastern Cape. So this was at a time when things in Ghana were economically very bad, and they were looking for a better life for themselves. And I believe that to this day, there's a large community of teachers and doctors in the Eastern Cape who moved there during my lifetime. And I wanted her father to be one of those. So that's why I wanted to situate the first part of the book there.
Talking about her father, can we talk about the contrast between Teacher and his wife, Precious? Why did you make them so different? Like they have something in common, but they don't really, because he's, okay, for lack of a better word, clever, and she doesn't see herself as fitting into that kind of scenario. And I wonder if that's the reason why Teacher gave so much to Karabo in terms of making sure that she's focused at school, having her getting these good grades. Is it because there was a lack in that relationship between him and his wife, or what was the situation there?
Yeah, it's always interesting for me doing these sorts of interviews because it makes me think about things that haven't been confronted with before. But now I think about it, so thank you for the question. My first wife was from the Congo, and we met when I worked on the oil field. There was a big gap between us, and I say this with the greatest respect, there was a big gap between us intellectually. So we never really had the sorts of conversations that I suppose she would have liked and also I would have liked. So in time we grew apart because we came from such different backgrounds that it was hard for us to, you know, to find a meeting place. And now you mention it, I think that describing Teacher and Precious in that way was in a way for me to tell the story of my first marriage, which has a lot of parallels in the story you read there.
Okay. So going back to Andre, the character, Snovoyo is asking how you depict the angels was quite interesting. Was there a specific reason for that? And just to add to that, why did you choose angels as the things that he saw?
Oh, I think that's because I have a strong interest in the afterlife, and I wanted him to be in tune with that or in touch with that. My parents, my father and my mother, were both very, very religious. So I grew up in a very strongly Christian household. And I've always wondered about what's on the other side. So this was a means for me to explore that.
Okay, so she's asking how you depict the angels was quite interesting. Was there a specific reason why they looked and behaved the way that they did?
Right. I think the question might be asking why weren't they your normal angels who you see in church books? And so why weren't they blonde and blowing trumpets? And I always think of angels sort of like superheroes. I hark back to the Marvel comics, which I read a lot of when I was smaller. So I saw them as being warriors in an army. So I wanted them to come across as strong and muscular and with swords and also playful at a certain time. So that's how I saw the angels as being this celestial army, which in some of the Methodist hymns, you know, we sing about things like that.
Mm-hmm. And talking about religion and how it came about as a theme in the book, let's talk a little bit about Father Majola as well as Andre's father and what came about when Andre saw Father Majola again years later. So what is the commentary there, would you say, about the Catholic Church? And obviously we know that over the years, there has been a lot of talk about how they treat younger boys within their congregation. But was that what you were trying to point a finger at, or were you trying to have a different conversation?
Well, I think that is it. And I didn't grow up a Catholic myself. My wife is a Catholic, so we go to the Catholic Church. There's a lot about the Catholic religion and the rites I don't understand. But I think in that story, what I was trying to do was to not shine a light on a well-known story of abuse of young boys by Catholic priests. But I've had friends of mine who have talked to me about the abuse that they have seen at the hands of the Catholic priests who were meant to look after them when they were in primary school or boarding school. I suppose that those stories have always stuck with me, and I wanted to you know, to say something about it. And I think it's a theme that comes through in more than one of my books. So I guess it's something that probably weighs on my subconscious in some fashion.
And I think in this particular book, it was also a gateway theme to the theme of homosexuality, which I think was, for me, it felt seamlessly explored, that by the time we understood Andre's sexuality, it didn't come as a shock. We expected it. We didn't expect anything other than that. But this book seems to be touching on a lot of very topical themes. Did you have any difficulty weaving them in together?
I suppose the part I had the most difficulty with was around the angels. They kind of just sort of inserted themselves into the story, and there was a time when I felt uncomfortable about it because I thought the audience might think that theme might be unbelievable. But then later, speaking to people who have read the book, they all said to me that the one thing that they enjoyed especially was the story around, or rather the insertion of the angels. So that was reassuring, but at the time I was writing it, I did feel some hesitation around inserting these perhaps mythical creatures into the story. It's the first time I've done that, and I did that with some hesitation.
So Katie Logan says, my question is, who is your favorite character, and is there a character you were hoping your audience would sympathize with the most? All the characters were very human in that they made lots of mistakes, so I didn't feel that there was a clear hero in the story.
Right. Probably my favorite character was actually the violin. And I haven't played a violin before. The first time I held a violin was about 2 weeks before the book launch. But it was quite weird in that I just had this, it was almost like a premonition that there has to be a violin in the story. So I sought out, and I think I did this on Facebook. So by the time I started the book, I put out a post saying that I was looking for somebody who could talk to me about speak to me about violins, how they are made, how they are played, how they are taught. And there were two gentlemen who reached out to me who happened to know each other. So one is a violinist and the other was a violin maker who had actually made a violin for the violinist. And spent a fair amount of time with them, and they really shared with me the rich history, the wonderful stories that relate to the violin. So seeing that I had never played a violin before, but I just had this urge or this voice in my head saying that there is a violin in this story, my favorite character was undoubtedly the violin.
Was it the most expensive violin that you liked, or the one that Mrs. Harrison bought, or the violin just in general?
Well, I think it was the violin in general. Actually, in an earlier draft, there were actually two expensive violins. There was the Guadagnini, and there was the Stradivarius. In speaking to the editor suggested, and I think he was right, that I take the Stradivarius out because it wasn't really, the Stradivarius didn't really add much to the story.
I like, how do you pronounce the name of the, I read it Godanini, and you pronounce it differently to me. So how do you pronounce it?
Oh, I may be wrong. But when I say this, I take Godanini.
Okay.
So the story there is that, and I found this out from my research, was that in Cremona, which is an Italian town, that was the center of violin making around the world. And I think, and I stand corrected here, I think it might have been in the 14th or 15th century. But so there were three prominent families, the Stradivarius, the Guadagnini, and the Guarneri. And of course, the one we, the most well-known today is probably the Stradivari, and the Stradivari set of violins. But the one I chose to write about was perhaps the third ranked of the top three, which was the Guadagnini.
And I liked how you brought it in as a sort of family heirloom. Now that it makes sense, obviously, if you've read the book, think of the summer scales, and I want to proceed to that family and how they came to be in the story. I think a lot gets left to question as to what exactly is happening in Mrs. Summerscale's life. Because yes, we know that she needs to sell this heirloom, which costs millions of pounds, but is it the one thing that she can do? Is it because she has no regard for music? Is it because she resents the person who gave her the heirloom? Or is it because she doesn't understand Nigel's need to have this in his life for the rest of his life? What is actually going on there on a maternal factor, and as well as on a class factor, because class is one of the things that you do explore quite well in the book?
It's a good question again. So once again, it forces me to remember things which have happened in my own life. And so Mrs. Summerscales is probably drawn from the mother of my first girlfriend, who was English French in London. And her mother was, she had separated from her husband, she was alone. She seemed to me to be unhappy, and she took her unhappiness out on other people. And to some extent, she took her unhappiness out on me. So I think I had the picture of her in her mind when I wrote about Mrs. Summerscales. It was something that happened so many years ago, but I think it was the wound or the interest, I think, was still lodged in my psyche. So I wanted to get that out.
She seems pretty delusional as well, if I might add, because I'm thinking about when the violin actually goes missing and the cops come to her house, and how she asks them to close off the ports to make sure that Karabo doesn't leave, and the police have to literally remind her that this is not a movie. Do you think that, I've never been to London or Britain, so I just want to understand, do you think that class in a country or even the city itself of that nature gives people certain delusions of grandeur, for lack of a better phrase?
Well, she lives in Kensington, which is sort of right next to Chelsea, so that's an upper class part of London. So when she interfaces with people from the police force, people who have a salary, whose work is several notches below her station, I believe that she would not, she sees them almost as servants, although her circumstances have been significantly reduced through the passage of time, but she still maintains that class, as it were. So I feel that's how a Mrs. Summerscales would react when she's confronted with working class citizens. She would almost see them as servants to do her bidding. And if that bidding includes closing the borders, well, she would ask them to do it. And actually, she would expect them to do it, right?
Okay. Bookish Nonclaim Kwanza says, this is a beautiful read. It touches on a lot of topics, one of them being discrimination based on your skin color. That was deep. So hers is a comment. Can I ask, with Nigel, right, how you describe him, especially at the start of our meeting him, no one would have ever assumed that his mother is Mrs. Summerskills. What's going on there?
So Nigel is also one of the awkward characters I like. So as I said, I'm drawn to awkward people, and I like to describe their story. So Nigel, being an only child with domineering mom, and so I felt that he was really doing the best that he could. It's a very strange family setup, I think, for him, you know, to live in that sort of, he lives in a bubble with the primary interaction he has being his mother. And then he meets a girl from South Africa, which normally he should not meet. And I think he struggles to understand her and understand himself. And I think that that relationship is probably one that didn't have enough time to mature for the two of them to really get to understand each other and where the other comes from. I think that he was out of his depth when it came to Karabo, and I don't think that he was necessarily the right person for her.
And talking about Karabo, I think a lot of us, when we were discussing the book, had a few questions about her character development, right?
Yeah.
And I think part of the questions were around how her relationship with teacher, that you spent quite a lot of time showing us when she was in Umtata, had a lot to do with who she became in later life, right? That it enabled, to a very large extent, the character that blossomed from Karabo, which was quite, I don't know if she has a comprehension of her place in society and the consequence of her actions. And never mind that she has this burden of being labeled yellow bone, but a lot of her own actions, just like the impulse to go steal the violin, just like the notion of I'm taking it with me to a different country to teach them a lesson, it has a sense of, I don't know if arrogance is the word, but I almost want to link it to, had her father been different while raising her, she might have known not to do A, B, C, and D. I don't know what you were trying to communicate in that relationship and how she became who she was.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point you make. I think that she worshipped her father. She saw him as sort of a superhero who could do no wrong. And I suppose that that indulgence, which I think that her mother speaks about, and she's not happy with it. She's quite forward and bold. And I think that that's what leads her to sort of go off the rails when she gets to London and she has the incident with the violin. And I think that that willfulness can be traced back to her father, who indulged her. And I think that with her father, she could do no wrong. I think that she carried that attitude, which is not necessarily a bad thing. And I think she took that forward with her when she went to the UK. Mm.
Can we talk a little bit about teacher in Ghana? What's going on there? He's lost weight. We assume that he's living in a more opulent setting because of the image that he sends to Karabo, while Karabo is in the UK. But when we come to realize that his life has actually gone down, and especially because of what Precious says at the end, that, oh, teacher, you're going to leave me in a setting like Umtata to come live in a back room in Ghana. What happened to teacher when he transitioned from South Africa back to his home country?
Well, I think with that, you have to remember the relationship he had, right? And, you know, once again, I have to think back to my first marriage as well. And I remember when I wanted to leave, I had my mother send my sisters to come and talk to me, like so they came to try to get me to change my mind. And on the face of it, there was nothing really wrong, right? It was just a sense of not being happy, not being fulfilled. So in writing the book and writing that scene about, or that story about Tita and Precious and why he would want to leave when there's nothing really wrong, you know, there's no one else involved in the marriage. It's just that sense of not being fulfilled. And I think that sense is what drove him. So it wasn't like leaving a job to go to another one. So you try to go to a better job, but it was just wanting to be out. And the fact that he ended up in more straitened circumstances was not the motivation for him to leave in the first place. He just needed to be free, as it were. I think that the fact that Karabu had also left the home made it easier for him.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about Mama Ama, right? At the beginning, she is the first to as well as her husband Bakofi, right? They are the ones who first lodged this idea of perhaps Karabo is not teacher's child, right? That's before we get introduced to Bill Harrison and the wife. For me, it said to me, right, initially, obviously, we didn't know that there was somebody else or there was somebody that we could suspect. So it was easy for us to believe that Karabo was teacher's child. But the fact that this came from grandparents, came within the home, that just because this child's complexion is not similar to any of ours, that therefore means your wife has to have had an extramarital affair in order for this child to have come out like this. Do you find that it is hard for people to, not just with complexion, but also with resemblance, especially in an African context, to accept that there can be a child born into a family that does not look like anyone in this family?
Well, I think it's very hard for people to wrap their heads around. And you see this a lot in a place like Ghana, where on the face of it, people are very, very polite, you know. So, and I think of probably those of you who know people from Ghana would probably describe them as generally shy away from confrontation. So there's a lot that is not said, and there's lots of undertones that sort of reside behind the warm welcome and the happy faces. So growing up, I would always sort of hear the undertones of when somebody has done something or been somewhere, there's always a subcontext or a substory which is not spoken about. And the other thing that I wanted to bring across in the story is that in Ghana, generally, not always the case, but generally, women are very, they're very strong. And I wanted to describe the grandmother like that. We have in some tribes, we have a matrilineal society where you inherit from your mother, not from your father. So that already puts women on, and in some respects, within the culture, they're more important than men. So I wanted her to embody that. And she is the one who voices the doubts about her granddaughter's parentage. And I think that's something that she would do. And it bugs her to the extent that when she has the opportunity to force a paternity test on her, she does so. And I believe that what drove her was probably the fact that right from the beginning, she wasn't happy with her son's choice of partner. So I imagine that that probably colored her attitude towards her granddaughter and what she did subsequently.
And just even talking about women in general in the story, I'll start in Ghana. The women that we meet in the prison have very interesting stories to tell, right? I forget the young woman's name that befriended Garabo and got arrested for having pointed thieves to a certain man's house, as well as the older woman who seems to have some form of mental breakdown because she accidentally killed her husband over no meat in the soup, etc. And I wonder, when you were telling us those stories of the women in that women's prison, what was the intention, or what were you trying to portray in terms of their relation, especially because I think that there's a lot of gender distinction in the story, right? What their relationship with the men that they had encountered.
Yeah, where that comes from, my niece in Ghana, she's a lawyer, and she does pro bono work in the prisons. So I went with her a couple of times to the prison just outside Accra. So what she does is that she tries to help the prisoners with the cases. She tries to get the cases through the legal system. So I had the opportunity to learn firsthand of some of the stories, so why some of the women were there. And what strikes you immediately is that the justice system in Ghana is very much weighted against those who are vulnerable. So if you have money and you have resources, you'll probably never end up in prison. But those who don't have any of those things aren't only sent to prison, but the system is so convoluted and so difficult to navigate that you will stay there for months and months, if not years. That's the norm. And I was struck by the stories these women told. Like, it was really heartbreaking. So the story about the girl who simply gave the directions to men who subsequently went to rob, that is a true story. And I remember sitting across from the girl as she told her story. She at the time was probably 17 years old, if not younger. And all she'd done was literally, she gave the directions to men who subsequently went to rob, not knowing who they were. But that sort of thing happens all the time. And if you don't have money, and if you're a woman and you're vulnerable, you don't read, you don't write, and if you fall into a situation like this, you will end up in prison because the system is totally biased against you. So that's what I wanted to come across.
Okay, I think I'm going to wind down now. But before I do, I want to ask, when you were busy with this book, what was your intention and what did you want people to grab? Because like I'm saying, there are a few themes that are explored in Yellow Bone that are either interwoven together or quite different from each other. So your intention when you were putting this together, what did you want your reader to extract from this?
Well, I wanted them to enjoy the story. So I think that was my prime motivation, to tell a story that people would enjoy. And I met people who hated the book, which is fine. And I keep trying to be a better writer. And I always look back to the narratives and I think around how I could have made them better. And there are some ideas I have around if I were to do Yellow Bone again, I would probably do it in a slightly different way, perhaps make the story tighter, strengthen the motivations of some of the other characters. But above all, the motivation was just to write a story that, you know, that people would enjoy, make them think, make them want to tell people about it because it was a good story. So the only motivation really was to write a good story.
It is. I believe that it is a good story. We did have questions about what you're saying, if it could have been a little bit more tighter, if we could have had a little bit more empathy towards some of the characters, if a little bit more was revealed here and a little bit more was revealed there. So there were instances of that, but one thing none of us could fault was your writing. So we really enjoyed your writing style, which was something that kept us going in the story. And obviously there are certain themes and places like what Snowfuya said earlier that we would have never been able to travel to had it not been for the book, right? So it is good enough to tell the next person about. So I have no doubt about that specifically. And I think that a lot of us did also enjoy the Ghana Karabo, because I think how she evolves there makes, for me personally, because throughout I'm like, this child is a spoiled brat. That's how I felt about her throughout the book. But in Ghana, her evolution in her character gave me something to empathize towards that character. So I enjoyed how she grew when she was in prison, and how she started understanding that there are consequences and that other people are also as important as she is. So the bond that she made with the woman that she shared her cell with, et cetera, for me then made me realize that she could grow and she could become a better person or a better character in the book. I see there's one more question. Was it intentional to attach heavy stories to women in the book, not only in Ghana, but in the book as a whole, with Precious's sister, for example, and Andre's mom and Mrs. Summerscales as well?
Yeah, I don't really have an answer to that. I tend to write more about women than I do about men. And especially in my day job, we do a lot of work around, that has to do with analytics and the bias that you see in the data sets that we use every day. And there's a preponderance of discrimination against the most vulnerable in our societies, and particularly women. So I think that's where it comes from. I have a natural urge, and I may do it clumsily, you know, but I try to shine light on those heavy stories, as you say, that seem to impact women disproportionately, because in my work I see that much more so than men.
Mm-hmm. Okay, as we're wrapping up, I always think it's quite a curious question to ask authors of any books that they would like to recommend, because we are a book club. So if you have any books that you would like to recommend to us that you feel, especially because our book club does focus on African and with a larger focus on South African authors, but African, no matter where they live in the world, or the diaspora as well. So if you have any books that have come to your attention or have impacted you, besides the ones that you mentioned earlier, feel free to just point us towards those.
So there's a book I'm reading now, which is a compendium of true stories or true accounts by Nigerian lesbians. It's called She Called Me Woman.
Okay.
I'm sort of 3/4 of the way through it. They talk about what it's like to be growing up lesbian in Nigeria. So that's a book I would recommend, because you hear the voices of people who don't necessarily have a platform to tell their story. And a lot of them have to hide in fear of being jailed, actually, because they recently passed legislation that makes it a criminal offense to be lesbian in Nigeria.
Yeah.
So that's a book I would recommend. It's called She Called Me Woman.
She Called Me Woman. And as you're saying that, it reminds me of a book that I recently finished by Chinelo Okparanda called Under the Udala Trees. I enjoyed that a lot. And it's also based in Nigeria, and it explores lesbianism in that country. And because of that legislation is why that book came to be. It is a work of fiction. So I assume that She Called Me Woman is, like you're saying, a bunch of essays, right, from firsthand accounts from women that are based in Nigeria.
Correct, yes.
Yes, so okay, that would be very interesting. Okay. Any fiction books that you can recommend?
Fiction books. And I'll have a quick look, I'll see what I'm reading now.
Okay, there's a comment here from Spogazi. For someone who hasn't read and finished a book in years, I must say thank you, Vuvu, for the book club and also Ikal for such a wonderful book and easy read for new readers, which is quite important, hey, because I find that if you're trying to get into reading, it's hard to read a book that you can't make sense of in terms of the writing style, which is why I'm saying we really enjoyed your writing style because it was easy to get into the book.
So thank you very much. And a quick recommendation, a fiction book I really enjoyed was The Fisherman. It's by a Nigerian author, and he was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It's a very, very good book.
Thank you so much for your time and for spending time with us.
No, it's a pleasure. And thank you for having me. And thank you for all those who took time on a Saturday morning to listen in. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And all the best for any other future books. I'm assuming more are coming that you will be gracing us with.
Sure. Yes, I have there's a manuscript I'm working on now with the editor. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
That's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please don't forget to rate and review this podcast. Any engagement on any of my platforms means a lot to me. And until next time, remember, every page turned is something learned. Keep turning pages.
I'd love to hear your thoughts about today's episode, so why not search for me on social media. On Instagram, I'm VuvuVena_reads. On Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, I'm VuvuVenaReads. And you can also find me on my website, which is www.vuvuvenareads.com. And until next week, I really do love you guys. Bye now.